The following Women's Spaces show was recorded on Monday, July 14th, 2025.
The woman in your life will do what she must do to comfort you and calm you down and let you rest now. The woman in your life, she can rest so easily. She does everything you do because the woman in your life is you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Women's Spaces. My name is Elaine B. Holtz, and I'm your host. With me at the board is my friend, my partner, my engineer, and my co-producer, Ken Norton. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Elaine.
God, I'm really excited for today's show. We're doing the second show of our new segment, Men's Spaces. Joining Ken on the phone this morning is going to be Dr. Kieran Fox.
He's not on the phone. I did the interview on Tuesday, so we'll be playing that recording.
Oh, okay. So it's pre-recorded.
Yes.
Oh, how exciting. Oh, that's right. You know what? You did it right into our office. I mean, that was really an amazing thing that we were able to do then. Anyway, today's show, we are doing the second show of our new segment, Men's Spaces. Joining Ken, it's been pre-recorded, is Dr. Kieran Fox, the author of the newly published book, I Am Part of Infinity, The Spiritual Journey of Albert Einstein. And, you know, we have Men's Spaces. We decided that we would bring in a lot of the men activists and what they're doing in the community, and we're really, really excited about that.
Yeah, this is the second time I've done this segment, Men's Spaces. I did it last month, and I interviewed Lee Pierce, an author of his book. So now this is something new. I'll be interviewing Dr. Kieran Fox.
Oh, I mean, it's so wonderful that you've joined me in this adventure here called Radio, Ken. I really thank you for that. Well, anyway, I have a few announcements. The first announcement I have is happy birthday to one of our activists in the community, Mary Moore. Mary Moore actually started in the 80s at the show Voices des Mujeres, which is on the air every Saturday from 12 to 1. I'm not sure if she's still active, but I know that she's very active. She's writing her bios, her memoirs with Lois Pearlman, and she's doing a lot for our community, and she has. So happy, happy birthday, Mary Moore. 90 years old, strong, amazing. I have a few other announcements here. On July 16th at 5 p.m., that's California time, and it will be at 8 o'clock Eastern time. Code Pink is going to do a local peace economy gathering. And if you want to participate, go to www.codepink.org, and you can get all the information about the local peace economy gathering. And it's going to be a great conversation with an activist, Sabrina Mahely and Jody Evans. So it should be a very, very, very informative program. So that's going to be July 16th. I believe that's Wednesday. This is the 14th, so that'd be Wednesday. And then we have another really important event happening in Sonoma County. It's a community protest, Stop Sheriff Ingram from Cooperating with ICE. I just can't believe what's going on in communities across the country. You know, it's called the gathering is going to be ICE out of Sonoma County, and that's going to be July 22nd at 5 p.m. at 575 Administration Drive. And I think it's very important that people show up and support this effort. You know, we want to, you know, it's really very interesting because 90% of us are immigrants here. I mean, the only ones that aren't immigrants are, you know, the Native Americans, particularly in the area in Sonoma County. And I'm just thinking of all the pain and suffering that's going on across the world. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. You know, I look at when I turn on Facebook and I see some of these cities being bombed and I see children walking around with their parents are gone. I just say, what are we doing? You know, why don't we sit down and talk about peace? Why is the only way that we seem to be able to solve any issues, and they're never solved because war is never ending, is we end up going to war. I mean, what is war? You know, maybe we need to wait and sit down and talk to each other and see how we can work out a way that all the people, all the children, all the women and children and men across the planet can have what they need. And they don't need a war. I mean, it's so destructive. It just, I mean, it makes me cry. And here's another thing that's happening. This is August, so mark your calendars. It's very important. It's the State of the Black Businesses that's going to be happening, August 15th. And we're really, really excited about that. I'll have some more information for that for you on Women's Spaces, www.womenspaces.com. But this is going to be a really, really good event to understand what's happening in Black communities with business. And a shout out to Nancy Rogers and the North Bay Black Business Chamber of Commerce. They are putting on this event, and it's going to be a very, very informative one. The event will feature Dr. Tara Lynn Gray from the office of Calvin Newsom, who will be discussing the future of entrepreneurship and the opportunities that lie ahead for business owners. So it's not just for Black business owners, even though it is the State of Black Businesses. It's also very informative for all businesses to sit down and see a local report. Well, as we do every Monday morning, we do our history is our strength, which is very, very important, I think. You know, it's really interesting. The first thing I'd like to talk about is the women's rights movement marks July 13th, 1848, as its beginning. On that sweltering summer day in upstate New York, young housewife and mother, can you believe it? They were housewives, young housewives and mothers. Elizabeth Cady Stanton invited tea with four women friends, excuse me, and that was the beginning of the suffrage movement. And also at that time they started writing what they called the Declaration of Sentiments, you know. And what happened was is that Stanton carefully enumerated areas of life where women were treated unjustly. And it's so interesting when you start thinking about what women went through. On this Declaration of Sentiments, they listed some of the things that women had to deal with. Number one, married women were legally dead in the eyes of the law. That's so interesting. Women were not allowed to vote. Women had to submit to laws where they had no voice in their formation. Married women had no property rights. Listen to this one. Husbands had legal power over and responsibility for their lives to the extent that they could imprison or beat them with impunity. Can you believe that the men had a right to beat their wives if they weren't behaving? And another thing, women divorce and child custody laws favored men, giving no rights to women. Women had to pay property taxes, although they had no representation in the levying of these taxes. Amazing, amazing. We have come a long way, baby, but I'll tell you something. In the last few years, we've gone a little bit backwards, and we have to start looking at that. Well, what we do every Monday morning, like I said, is the history is our strength. And let me go over these few things with you, which I think are very important because these are the shoulders that we're standing on. These are the women that came before us and said, you know, enough is enough. We are women. We have rights. We were the ones who bring forward life. We bring forward the children. And yet we had no rights. I mean, our children weren't even our children. We were considered like property. I think it was like cattle, to be honest with you. And so, therefore, the children belonged to the man just as well as we did. So we have come a long way, but we have to still continue what I call an uphill fight. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me anymore. It doesn't make sense to me why people make such a big deal about the fetus, and yet when it comes to the children of war zones, it's like, oh, well, this is just happening. You know, they just have to get through it. I mean, just think about it for a while. I don't think we think enough about things. I think that we just let them, oh, it'll all work itself out. No, we have to stand up. We have to speak out. We have to say something. You know, that song that I play all the time, by our silence, we give our consent. You know, it doesn't make sense anymore that we are silent. We can't afford to be silent. I mean, we're losing so many rights. It's mind-boggling to me. Well, here we go with our history as our strength, talking about some of the women that stood up and had something to say. You know, had something to say. I mean, I've been an activist for over 50 years now, and I just can't believe how we go a step forward and then we go five steps backwards. It just doesn't make sense to me. But what does make sense to me is if we all stand up and say enough is enough, we have a right to a voice. Well, here we go. On July 14th, 1917, which was very, very interesting, 16 women from the National Women's Party were arrested while picketing the White House demanding universal women's suffrage. They were charged with obstructing traffic. And another thing that was interesting about on July 14th, 1917, when they were protesting, demanding universal women's suffrage, in other words, but demanding the right to vote, World War I was going on. And so when the women that were protesting, they were actually considered traitors, and many of them were arrested. And, you know, like I said, we've come a long way, baby, and the shoulders we're standing on and the struggle that they pursued, you know, what strikes me is so interesting is when I listen to some of these women who are against women. I mean, it shocks me because the women who are in power today would not be in power if it were not for these women who stood up for them. Well, in July 19th to the 20th in 1848, the Seneca Falls Convention, the first women's right convention, is held in Seneca Falls, New York. It was called the beginning of the women's rights movement. And that's when they presented this declaration of sentiments because they felt it was very important that women should understand that they have a right. They have a right to speak out. And it took a lot of effort. I don't know if you people read much about the suffrage movement, but they were waterboarded, arrested. I mean, you name it, and it happened to them. But guess what? We did get the vote, but we got the vote by one vote, which is very, very interesting. Just imagine one vote. One congresswoman, one senator's mother sent him a telegram and says, vote for the women's right to vote. And that's how it happened. Well, and here we are, 2025, and we're losing the rights over our own body. How did that happen? I mean, you think about it, and I believe it happened because once we got the right to vote, once we got the right to have control over our own bodies, we felt, oh, that's it. We don't have to do anything anymore. Well, we've learned wrong because there were many forces that were happening that were willing and ready to take away our right to our own body. You know, it's oftentimes, I remember when I would go down here in Santa Rosa, I'd go down to 4th Street and I'd see these beautiful young women. They had all these tattoos on their body and I'd walk up to them and I would say, you know something, when I was growing up, this was outlawed. I could not do this. In fact, I did put a tattoo. I put two of them on my body and my mother had them removed immediately and made me feel like I was I don't know how they made me feel, but it really wasn't very good. Now, here is something that I found very interesting on July 18th, 1892. And this woman made her transition in 1980. So she's got a happy birthday here. Doris Fleshman Bernice, the first married woman to gain U.S. passport in her maiden name in 1925. In other words, she could say Fleshman, Doris Fleshman Bernice, first married woman to gain a U.S. passport in her maiden name in 1925. And she was a writer and editor for the New York Tribune and also a publicist. But this was July 18th, 1892, making her transition in 1980. Imagine this woman speaking out and demanding the right to use her maiden name. Excuse me, I'm having a little bit of trouble with my voice here, Ken. Well, I think it's time for us to take a musical break. Are we about there, Ken? The song I'll be playing is one of my favorites. You know, I've waited a long time. You know, last time we had Men's Spaces on, you know, I also was able to play a song that I was really, really excited about. And this song is really another one that I'm excited about. It's sung by Neil Young. And you know, I really believe of all the songs that Neil Young wrote, this is one of his best. You know, it's called Light a Candle. And the first line, I think, is very interesting. Instead of cursing the darkness, light a candle for where we're going. There's something ahead worth fighting for. Now, just think about that. There's something ahead worth fighting for. And right now, we're fighting for our democracy. So this song, I mean, this is really, really a powerful, powerful song. You know, and then there's another one. It's a chance to give new meaning to every move we make. In the cavern, in the cave, where we come from. I mean, just think about it. Just think about it. I mean, I, myself, my curiosity goes to the first people or the first woman. I mean, how did she know that, you know, even to get go into labor, it must have been a great mystery. All of a sudden, this thing is coming out of her body, which, you know, is crying. I mean, can you imagine the first women that were giving birth? I mean, it's just, and I think, how do people know what to eat? How did people know where to go? You know, they didn't even have fire. They definitely didn't have light bulbs. I mean, just imagine what it was like. So this song really speaks to a lot of different things. I will, and then after the song, I will be turning over the show to my co-producer, Ken Norton, and he's going to be interviewing Dr. Kieran Fox, the author of the newly published book, I Am Part of Affinity, The Spiritual Journey of Albert Einstein. What is interesting to me about this interview and the book, it was inspired by a lot of the information found in the book Einstein and the Poet by Dr. William Hermans. Hermans was a mentor to Ken, and Ken did a lot of research for the book and is mentioned several times in Dr. Fox's newly published book, I Am Part of Affinity, The Spiritual Journey of Albert Einstein. We don't think of Albert Einstein as having a spiritual journey. It's really interesting, but he was a very high level of thought. You know, he believed in the mystery of the cosmos, the mystery of the universe. I had an interesting conversation with a friend of mine, and we were talking about the fact that we don't understand the mystery that we live in. You know, I mean, think about it. Think about it. You know, we don't fall off the planet. That, to me, is the most amazing thing about the situation that we're in, that here we are on this Earth in the middle of a universe. And what they're talking now about black holes and all that other stuff, and this is what we're part of. It's a great mystery. You know, some people call you a woohoo if you believe in stuff like this. But I believe that this is a miracle that we're living in. And, you know, one of the things, another thing that I thought is very, very interesting about what Neil Young's song here that I found is very, very, very important to really start thinking about it, is that it's part of history. So light a candle in the darkness so others might see ahead. Light a candle in the darkness when you go. What a strong song. So let's go ahead, Ken. Let's take a musical break. And when we return, we're going to be listening of the pre-recorded conversation that you had with Dr. Kieran Fox, talking about his book, I Am Part of Affinity, The Spiritual Journey of Albert Einstein. So let's go ahead. We're going to be listening to Light a Candle, written and sung by Neil Young.
Instead of cursing the darkness, light a candle for where we're going. There's something ahead worth looking for. When the light of time is on us, we will see our moment come, and the living soul inside will carry on. It's a chance to give new meaning to every move we make, through the caverns and the caves where we come from. On us, we will see what we can be, and the ancient ones can sleep an easy sleep. In the hallways of the ages, on the road to him. history. What we do now will always be with us. It's a chance to give new meaning to every move we make in the caverns and the caves where we come from. Darkness, light a candle for where we're going. There's something ahead worth looking for. When the light of time is on us, we will see our moment come, and the living soul inside will carry on. Light a candle in the darkness, so others might see ahead. Light a candle in the darkness when you go.
Oh, that was by Neil Young, Light a Candle. I just love that song. And I love this. In the hallways of the ages, on the road to history, what we do now will always be with us. And you know, what we ignore now will always be with us. That goes with climate change. And look what it's upon us now. And somehow we're not doing the job that we should be doing. Well, for you folks just joining us, I want to remind my listeners the opinions expressed here are not necessarily the opinions of its board of directors, its members, and Women's Spaces. Boy, remember that. For you just joining, I want to remind my listeners the opinions expressed here are not necessarily the opinions of the station, the board of directors, its members, and Women's Spaces. Well, now I have the honor of welcome back. You're listening to Women's Spaces, a segment of Women's Spaces. Today, I'm going to turn it over to my co-host, Ken Norton. And go, Ken, it's all yours right now.
Thank you, Elaine. So this next part of the show is a segment we're calling Men's Spaces. I did it once before last month, and so this month I had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Kieran Fox. He is a medical doctor and neuroscientist. He is presently working out of UC San Francisco. So I'm going to cue this up for you, and we'll begin the interview.
Welcome to Men's Spaces, a special segment of Women's Spaces radio show. I am your host, Ken Norton. I have the pleasure to interview Dr. Kieran Fox, the author of the newly published book, I Am a Part of Infinity, The Spiritual Journey of Albert Einstein. Welcome, Dr. Kieran Fox. Welcome to Men's Spaces.
Hey, Ken. It's so nice to finally connect with you.
May I address you as Kieran?
Yeah, of course, of course.
Okay, great. Allow me to say a little bit about you. You sent me your bio. Dr. Kieran Fox studied medicine at Stanford University. He has an MD and a PhD and holds a doctorate in cognitive neuroscience from the University of British Columbia. He is a physician scientist at the University of California, San Francisco, where his research centers on the neural mechanisms and therapeutic potential of meditation practices and psychedelic medicines. He lives in San Francisco. I Am a Part of Infinity is his first book. Well, congratulations on that publication of that book.
Yeah, it's long time coming. So,
yeah, I have read your book. It is marvelous. You provided a backstory to Einstein's spiritual journey through his interest in philosophers and scientists over the ages, especially Spinoza and Pythagoras. I think your book would assist any professor of the humanities to teach their course. Have you been approached at all?
I know the publisher has been canvassing schools. I can't remember exactly what they call it, but they do a thing where they look around and see if anyone's interested in having it as part of a course. And she said that a lot of people clicked on the link because they can track that, but I haven't heard any specific offers yet. So
okay, I bet that it'll come.
Yeah, that'll be the day. If it's being taught in a classroom, that'll be a really nice feeling for sure.
Yeah, sure. How did you first become interested in Einstein?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure when that started. I think from a really early age in high school, I was really interested in physics and was definitely reading kind of, you know, popular books about Einstein, about relativity, what's the book? Stephen Hawking, Brief History of Time, the Elegant Universe guy, Brian Greene. So just, you know, sort of popular books about physics and cosmology and the origin of the cosmos. And so I was always interested. And then I was also interested in Spinoza, yeah, as early as high school. And so those interests just kind of kept going in the background. I didn't really understand or know that they would converge eventually, but they did and turned into this book. So
what is it about Spinoza that attracted you?
I think it was the idea of oneness, the idea of that body and mind are really, you know, just two aspects of a single thing and that they're not really different at heart. I was only 17, I think, or 18 when I first started reading Spinoza, and I could already sense that there was this, you know, really rigorous attempt to come up with a monistic philosophy or some kind of oneness underlying what seems to be different. And that attracted me from a really early age.
What is your experience with religion or spirituality before writing the book?
Yeah, so around that same age too, around 17, 18, I was taught about meditation by I had a really super cool high school teacher who spent his summers actually in India with a guru. And he taught us, in addition to teaching us about Western philosophy in high school, he literally taught us how to meditate in class. So I was exposed, you know, really, and it's probably more common these days, but this is, you know, in the early 2000s. So, pretty rare experience back then. And I got into meditation. I just loved it right away. You know, I had my first session and got really into it and was living in a monastery within a couple of years, a Zen Buddhist monastery, and then eventually in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery. So, long before I ever did graduate school, actually, or medical school, I was actually, you know, living in Asia and spending a lot more of my time doing spiritual practice, as I discussed, you know, in the introduction to the book. So,
well, that seemed like a real good preparation for you in writing this book.
Yeah, yeah.
When did you know that you wanted to write the book?
So I was actually working on what is going to become my second book, about more my wheelhouse of spirituality and neuroscience, kind of the brain science of meditation and spiritual practice, which is much more what I spent my graduate degree working on. But in the middle of that, I was kind of looking for just examples from the Western scientific tradition of other people who'd sort of seen this bridge between science and spirituality, or, you know, just some good quotes from people who had maybe also felt that these things were compatible, or that there was a good story to be told here and that they weren't necessarily in conflict. And I kept coming across these quotes from Einstein, such as the one at the very front of the book where, you know, human being is the part of the whole called by us universe, and that, you know, our sense of individuality is kind of an optical illusion, as he called it. I came across these quotes and I just felt, again, with all the background I had in Eastern religion in particular, I felt there's such an obvious affinity here, and it could be a coincidence, but it doesn't seem like it. And I just wanted to dig a little bit deeper. And the next thing I knew, I was kind of sucked into the rabbit hole. Mm. And I realized this is its own book. I mean, it's a side quest. And in my naivete, I was a first-time author, of course. And I thought, this will be a quick and easy book. I'll just focus on, you know, just on Einstein's spirituality and pantheism. And that'll be a quick and easy thing to do. And I can finish it during med school. Which I nearly did, but it also kind of nearly killed me. So ended up being a lot more research and reading than I anticipated, and a lot longer actually than I originally thought the book would be. So that's how, yeah, it was kind of just came out of nowhere and just sort of called me, and I sort of had to do this book first. So
when did you travel to see Einstein's library?
So that was toward the end of writing the book. That was in February 2023, And I'd actually had contact with them before that. So when I first started writing, it was January 2020. And one of the first things I found, other than William Herman's book, was that there was the Science Center Archive. And I started browsing online and I actually emailed them and I said, are outsiders allowed to visit or is this just for experts? And they said, yeah, sure. And it ended up taking 3 years to get there. But they had sent me a list of all the books in his library and they should have showed me how to use the online resources to get into his letters and so on. And it was the list of books in his library was also something that really grabbed my attention just because there were so many interesting volumes there. And a big part of the reason I ended up going to the archives, because most of the letters and so on are digital and they're online now and you don't need to be there in person to see them. But his books, I was really eager to look inside his books and see if there was any highlighting or commentary and so on. And of course, that becomes kind of one of the central features of the book. I think one of the most original parts is finding these things that he happened to highlight in these books that, you know, no one's really ever talked about, that he had, you know, five copies of the Tao Te Ching in his library, for example, or all this Greek philosophy. So, it was a 3-year journey before I finally got there, but then eventually made it over to see something.
Yeah, you can tell through the notes or the highlights that's just what grabbed Einstein's interest.
Yeah.
You know, that's fantastic that you're able to do that. What authors were the greatest influence on Albert Einstein's life?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think there's a lot of thinkers, and it's not always obvious that he studied their writings in detail, but more that he sort of vibed almost with some of the key ideas. And Spinoza is one of them. And he said himself in some of his letters, you know, I'm not an expert. I haven't studied Spinoza in depth. I'm not a Spinoza scholar, but I do really feel an affinity for this. And I think he frequently references Spinoza as kind of his favorite philosopher or the person with whom he's most closely aligned, even though he doesn't feel like it's a perfect setup, including with his discussions with William Hermans, of course. So I think that's a huge part of the book, of course, is focusing on Spinoza and why Einstein must have been interested in him and, you know, the sort of affinity of ideas there. And that, like I said, that sense of oneness. I think another really important influence, which it's a bit more circumstantial, the evidence, but I tried really hard to trace it in the book, is Pythagoras, who, again, is not really a writer in the modern sense and didn't leave any writings that we can confidently attribute to him. But definitely sort of inspired a school of thought in ancient Greece that's persisted, as I trace in the book, it's persisted down to the present day, mainly with this key idea of sort of the mathematical nature underlying the rest of the universe. The mathematical kind of core or a harmonious order that's according to mathematical proportions and is really, even though it's almost, we don't even notice it. It's so deeply saturates our science. We don't even notice that it's a worldview, right? Where it's like, oh, of course we use mathematics and physics to try to understand the whole universe and we can just write equations that apply on the other side of the universe. And that's, we take that totally for granted. But of course, that's actually a really revolutionary idea that, not only that's how the universe works through mathematical proportions and equations that accurately describe its inner workings, but that the human mind can grasp those and explain them to other people and write that down kind of for posterity. So I think those are some of the main influences. And then, of course, there's a whole bunch of subtler Eastern influence, which I also discuss a lot in the book. So sort of Einstein's, you know, vague familiarity with Buddhism, his travels in East Asia, when he was in his early 40s, and as well as his, you know, talks with thinkers like Rabindranath Tagore, who were mystical poets who, you know, were really, really deeply steeped in the Upanishads and sort of the non-dualist tradition in India. And they had these kind of pretty remarkable conversations between people, you know, back in the 1930s, where, you know, the world's greatest scientist or physicist is sitting down with this, the first non-European to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, and talking about mysticism and the Upanishads and so on. And so, again, that's something I, of course, trace out in the book. And again, I just don't want to push it too far and say that, you know, he studied those writings in detail, because I don't think that's necessarily the case. But he was sort of exposed to all these different worldviews and ideas and traveled very, very broadly and sort of, it seems like, soaked up a lot of this stuff into his own worldview.
Oh, that's so fascinating that he would have that idea of this unity, this oneness of the universe that his mind was part of, and the nature that he's experiencing.
Yeah.
And that Pythagoras, what did he live about 500 BC?
Yeah, I think it's usually he's pretty legendary. If you start reading the original sources, there's very little detail, but I think the usually accepted dates are roughly 570 to 500 BCE, something around there, although people disagree. I can't remember which dates I put in the book, but something around that time frame. So,
yeah, I remember, you know, growing up with a Pythagorean theory, you know, that you can relate a right triangle, the sides of a right triangle.
Right.
And to think that that was such a revolutionary thing way back at 500 BC, and then we inherit this type of thing and this harmony of certain harmony of the spheres that he believed in, that it reminds me of Kepler and his music of the spheres.
Yeah. I mentioned in the book actually that it's not just Einstein. It's not like Einstein was some exception who sort of, you know, caught onto this Pythagorean idea or this Pythagorean notion that science and spirituality could be synthesized. It was everybody, really. I have direct quotes from a lot of the major quantum physicists saying the same thing, that, you know, this is basically continuing this Pythagorean quest, especially Wolfgang Pauli, who I focus on in the book. And then I have quotes from, you know, going back to the founders of the scientific revolution as well, that Newton saw himself in this tradition. So did Kepler, so did Galileo, and so did Copernicus. Actually, all of them understood, you know, very consciously that they had sort of revived this ancient Greek tradition that looked back to Pythagoras as kind of the source of this key concept, which, again, we take so for granted that it's almost hard to realize how important it actually is and how much it guides all of our physics. But,
you know, to think that nature reveals itself through mathematics. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a way of talking to us.
Yeah.
You know, I noticed that we have a little dog, how she attempts to communicate with us all the time. I mean, as soon as her bowl is empty, she's on my case to fill her bowl, even though she may not eat it for another 2 hours. But there's this, you know, relationship that you see that we have here just with a pet, which I think is a great way for people to be introduced to this unity of nature, and that we are able to relate to it. The German philosopher Schopenhauer seemed to greatly influence Einstein also. And here's a man, you know, a philosopher, I think, of the will, and talks about the will. And Schopenhauer was also influenced by Vedic literature.
Yeah.
So this must have really captured the imagination of the scientists in the 50s, especially. I think Oppenheimer even quotes the Bhagavad Gita seeing the bomb go off.
Yeah.
So that you think that humans have been wrapping their minds around this for quite a while. And then somehow it took an Albert Einstein to help simplify it in a way and to make it standard for us to think of this unity. Mm-hmm. How much did Einstein's spiritual journey affect your spiritual journey or your educational journey or your scientific research?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in some ways, I think you mentioned earlier, it was almost like a culmination of all the stuff I'd been doing with my life. You know, since I turned 19 or so and left home, it was kind of all these different, you know, spiritual practices and the science I've been studying and stuff I've been reading for pleasure and physics. And so in some sense, it kind of drew everything together into one kind of unity almost, where I was just everything that I kind of been interested in for 20 years came together in this book in a really sort of nice, natural way. But I think definitely, and I described a little bit of this, a little bit of the personal stuff in the introduction to the book, that reading about this stuff, really thinking about it deeply for a few years actually is, was itself kind of transformative. And you could, you know, there's moments where I could definitely feel the actual experience of this, where it's not just a discussion about these ideas, but you can kind of, Spinoza actually talks about this specifically, where it's like a flip of perception where you don't see anything different, but you suddenly can see the unity of all things, and you can kind of see things as an expression of one thing. And that's a very difficult to describe. So I hope I'm trying to do it a little bit of justice, but, I describe it again in the intro to the book, and it's a really beautiful experience to sort of be walking around, especially when I was walking around in nature, in the forests, in the, you know, the peninsula near, south of San Francisco. And, It's a really beautiful experience to be, you know, reading and reading about pantheism and oneness. And it's very intellectual and in the head, and these difficult books that are often in pretty archaic language. And then to sort of be like, oh, I'm having the experience now. I'm having the perception, the direct kind of awareness of this, as opposed to just thinking about it. And yeah, that was definitely something that came up more often as I wrote the book. So
would you call that what Einstein called cosmic religious feeling?
Yeah, I think it's something similar. It's so hard to know what other people's, you know, religious or mystical or spiritual experiences directly feel like. But, you read these things in the books, and then suddenly there's sort of an intellectual approach where you're like, oh, that's interesting. Or I can sort of approve of that intellectually, or, I can sort of understand how that might be true, but then to suddenly be feeling exactly what they're feeling. And then I think it makes a lot more sense after the fact, when you've had that experience yourself and you're like, oh, that's what they've been trying to describe, is this feeling that's very, very subtle and very hard to put into words. But yeah, that's definitely how it felt to me. So
I imagine that it also gives you courage to venture into areas that others may not have ventured before.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of how the whole book was, in a sense. And then there's, as you know, you've seen some of the reviews, there's been some pretty scathing criticism of the book, and people saying, you know, people in the Einstein field who are just saying, like, you've got this all wrong, and he wasn't really spiritual, and it's all mistranslations, and it's all exaggerated. And I'm not an Einstein scholar. I'm not a biographer. I'm not a physicist. So I am kind of an outsider to this world. And it was a bit of a like a bold move, and, you know, in some people's minds, a very inappropriate move. That's what I've heard from some scholars, that, you know, you're not qualified to write this book and you're in no position to say anything. And I felt, again, after partly from those experiences and partly from all the research, that I think this is correct. And I think there's something really valuable here, and I want to share it. And again, you know, there's all the notes and sources are there, and anyone can read it for themselves and look up the quotes and so on. And I think, it definitely gave me kind of the confidence, or just the sort of, inner confidence or certainty to be like, this is something really valuable. And, you know, maybe it's not perfect, or maybe there's some mistakes, but I think this is something really important that's worth exploring for other people as well. So,
well, the book is very heavily referenced. I know it took me a while to read it, because I'm someone that likes to go back and check the footnotes. Who is he quoting? Where did it come from? I especially have an interest because I worked on a book called Einstein and the Poet, In Search of the Cosmic Man. It was published in 1983, and I worked with this with my mentor, Dr. William Hermans, who knew Albert Einstein for 34 years. Mm-hmm. And reading your book, it really helped think, it's not just what my spiritual my adopted father would say about it, William Hermans, that there are others who are also saying the same kind of thing. That, I mean, there are authors that were also influenced by Einstein that would write about some of this stuff too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think Einstein himself, you know, again, I dug through so many letters and I read a lot of stuff that didn't end up being used, of course, because it just wasn't relevant. But to find kind of the really juicy letters where he starts talking about spirituality to, you know, his son, Edward, or to the Queen of Belgium, there's some really great quotes from those letters. And I think, yeah, I found Einstein and the Poet very early on. I can't remember exactly. It was like a few weeks after I started writing the book. I think I found it on Amazon. Because I was just looking up everything I could about Einstein and religion. And I think there's so many longer discussions. And I think it's a real shame, because I think so many people recorded conversations with Einstein about politics and about pacifism and, you know, physics, all kinds of other topics, which are, of course, interesting as well. But I think that side of him was kind of underrated in his lifetime, and his cosmic religion was really not appreciated by most people. And so there's very few people who engaged in these discussions, much less wrote them down. And I think William Hermans' book and you know, your work putting all that together was really important, because it's the only kind of long form conversations that we have that were written down, and everything else is kind of isolated quotes here and there or brief essays that Einstein wrote. So I think it's a really valuable resource in that sense.
And there's really no formulas in the book, no mathematical formulas.
Yeah.
Dr. Hermans was trained as a sociologist, and he was a poet. The defining experience in his life was when he was a survivor of the Battle of Verdun. He discovered his conscience at the time. And these were questions that then William Hermans would ask Albert Einstein. Mm-hmm. You know, I was first attracted to Albert Einstein after the Vietnam War. And I was just, it was during the Vietnam War. In 1970, President Nixon had just invaded a neutral country, Cambodia, and it caused an uproar on a campus that I was attending at San Jose State. Mm-hmm. And that following summer, I was just really in a despair. I was wondering, am I doing the right thing studying material science and engineering? Am I just going to be a tool of the military industrial complex? Is there, what should I do? And I went into a library and I discovered a biography of Albert Einstein. Mm. And what struck me is that he was only one of four people to sign the European Manifesto in 1914 to protest that war that my mentor went into, World War I. Only one out of four academicians. Well, there's, how many academicians does Germany have at the time? Yeah. Quite a bit. And here's just this, you can't even count on the fingers on your one hand how many people dared to sign that protest letter.
Yeah.
And this is something that he would speak with my mentor about, is conscience too, how important it is to be a person of conscience. And so that, when I met my mentor just crossing this street in front of the engineering building after their first class for the fall semester of 1970, here's this gentleman in a suit passing me by, and then I nod my head and he nods back. And then suddenly I hear from behind, "Do you know me?" Mm. So I said, "No, I'm sorry, I don't." He says, "Well, do you type?" So yes. And I was really grateful. My mother sent me to a summer school after eighth grade to study touch typing. So I said, "Yes, I do." And she said, "Well, would you like to help me with a manuscript I'm writing of a book? What is it called?" He said, "Einstein and the Poet, and I'm the poet." So I thought the world just disappeared all around me when he said that. Mm-hmm. To think that here I had discovered a hero in Albert Einstein earlier, just a couple of weeks earlier, and now to have the synchronistic meeting with this man who actually knew him for 34 years. So this idea, first of this, of having a conscience, what do you think Einstein meant by conscience?
Yeah, I think that's, there's a whole chapter on kind of his ethics in the book, which talks about this a fair bit. And I think the key of it is you have some inner standard, I guess, or some inner ideal of what's right and wrong. And that's independent of what, you know, the mob or the democracy or, you know, the religion around you feels. And that's kind of the bottom line, I think, of it, is that you have to stick to your own judgment and your own notion of what's right and wrong. And that doesn't necessarily not change either. I think that's one of the most interesting parts about Einstein, is this evolution of not only his ideas and his physics, but also his ethics, where, you know, he starts off, as you mentioned, an absolute pacifist from a very young age, actually, which I talk about in the book. You know, just sort of this inherent, intrinsic revulsion to violence and to militarism and Germany's militaristic society and its militaristic school system. And then the Nazis come along, and then he has kind of a crisis of that conscience where he said, well, you know, he was admiring Gandhi as kind of the greatest living exemplar of ethics in the world. And then he had to sort of turn around and say, actually, we need to fight Hitler. We need to, you know, Belgium needs to fight back. You can't just roll over. Nonviolence isn't going to work in this case. It's a great ideal, but at the same time, it can't be the final arbiter in this kind of situation, because it'll just mean the end of all good things and all good people if we sort of advocate nonviolence. Hitler would just roll over and kill everybody. And I think that's you mentioned something really interesting about your own studies of engineering in the middle of a war. And that's something I think tortured Einstein for the rest of his life, was he recommended research on into and, you know, possibly building an atomic bomb. And everyone knows how that turned out, of course. And, you know, the, you know, it's debated, you know, the weight of his signature and his letter to Roosevelt, you know, how much did that change things? But I think it definitely got the ball rolling. I think that's kind of indisputed by most people. And I think he was, again, even though he didn't participate particularly in the Manhattan Project, he felt tortured by this the rest of his life, that, you know, his great name was lent to building the worst weapon ever, and that the weapon was used against civilians in the end and not against military targets. And Oppenheimer, likewise, you know, I think many people have seen the movie now, and that he likewise had this sort of very idealistic youth and wanted to understand nature and quantum physics, and then ended up, you know, leading this project and felt extremely guilty and extremely conflicted about how, you know, science in general, but also his mind and his genius in particular, were put towards these political ends and these militaristic ends, and again used against civilians ultimately and not military targets. So I think it's a conflict. I actually opened the book that way, and that was very deliberate, that you know, science is this beautiful thing, and we have these genius figures come along and reveal us new knowledge, and we sort of almost like this divine download, we understand the secrets of nature, and then people turn it into weapons immediately, right? And that's Einstein's case, is kind of the paradigm of that. And it's a really sticky situation that we don't have an answer. There's no answer to that yet, right? It's kind of great power gives us, you know, great knowledge gives us great power to do good and evil, and it doesn't give us any moral wisdom about how to use it. And so there's this really beautiful side to science, and, you know, it's really nice to talk about the harmony and the Pythagorean ideal, and we're getting these mathematical revelation. You're like, oh yeah, but then people with, you know, people with, you know, looser morals turn those into really deadly weapons as soon as they can. So it's a double-edged sword for sure.
Well, when he left Germany, he knew that he had worked with scientists in Germany who were brilliant, especially Heisenberg. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know how far Heisenberg would take that knowledge.
Yeah.
And his, genius in working with physics and mathematics, how far that would go to develop the German nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. So there was something weighing on him besides his deep feeling of being against war. At the same time, he was wise enough, I guess, to know the, you know, it can be, it's always going to be a two-edged sword, it looks like. Mm-hmm. This, the way knowledge is used. Well, I think we're approaching the end of the segment of Men's Spaces. Why don't you give us your contact information and how to order this book, I Am Part of Infinity, The Spiritual Journey of Albert Einstein.
I've got a personal website. It's just my name. It's kieranfox.com. I made a website for the book as well. It's imapartofinfinity.com. And it's really easy to find. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's on ebook readers like Apple Books and Kindle and so on, Indigo bookstores. So, yeah, really easy to find online if you just Google it. And it's on all the major kind of seller websites. And, my contact info is on both those websites if you want to reach out and email me or whatever. So.
Well, I really appreciate you coming to Men's Spaces to speak with me about the book, Kieran. This is it was definitely a pleasure for me to read, just to see that just how much what I learned from my mentor, William Hermans, how much of this was, you know, wasn't just inside his little mind. It was also shared among other people, and your book shows that, especially in the notes that you have meticulously kept and referenced in writing the book. So thank you so much. I wish you a great success in getting it into the schools and into people's hands.
Yeah, well, thank you for your part in preserving the records of their conversations and for letting me use some photos in the book. And really appreciate your help and your openness as well. So, and for having me on the show. Thank you.
Well, you're certainly welcome. Thank you, Dr. Kieran Fox, and for you listeners to listen to us speak on Men's Spaces. Periodically, we will broadcast Men's Spaces as a special segment of Women's Spaces. Thank you so much.
Wow. Wow, that was great, Ken. How did you feel doing that?
Oh, I really enjoyed talking with Kieran about, you know, his literary venture with this, and then had all these flashbacks, memories when I was working with my mentor, Dr. Hermans, on the book Einstein and a Poet. So it was gratifying for me to be recognized, that the book, that this book was recognized, you know, that was published in 83, and it's really getting more recognition now.
Amazing.
Through Dr. Kieran's book.
Well, thank you so much, Ken, and a special shout out to Dr. Kieran Falk, the author of the newly published book, I Am Part of Infinity, The Spiritual Journey of Albert Einstein. And it shows that we've been struggling for peace a long time. A reminder, well, that's it for the show. A reminder, tell your friends that Women's Spaces will be aired again at 11 p.m. this evening. I'm so excited I get to listen to my show and also listen to this interview again. I really learned a lot about Einstein and a lot about the spiritual journey of this very, very famous scientist and how he felt about the invention of splitting the atom, etc. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. You've been listening to Women's Spaces. I'm your host, Elaine B. Holtz. And I remind you at the end of every show, our children are our future. We must never lose sight of that.
Now, the woman in your life, she can wait so
The previous Women's Spaces show was recorded on Monday, July 14th, 2025.